Hi, everybody. We want to thank our sponsor, Legion M. They are a wonderful company. We love working with them. You can go to their website, Legion M. They're also on all the various socials. They do really fun meetups. You can talk to directors. You can become a part of the projects they choose. They even have a program right now where you can help them find great movies to support. So go to their website to learn more. We also want to remind you that we have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies. Hi, I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
And you're listening to Maltin on Movies. And I'm very pleased to say that our guest today is actor, director, musician, scholar, teacher, polymath, and so much more, Peter Weller.
How are you, Leonard? How are you, Jesse?
And what a
voice.
I am
fine. We are fine. So you know, delighted to have you here.
I'm happy to be here, and particularly with, like I said, I've been a fan of yours for a while now, and a more intelligent commentator or assessor of film I don't think I could find. So I'm happy to be here. Happy to be here.
That's very kind of you. Thank you. Flattery will get you everywhere.
That's right.
I missed a chance to interview you in 1987 when a little film you'd made called RoboCop came out. But I asked a stringer from Entertainment Tonight, who was in New York, where you were at the time, to ask my questions for me that I could put into this piece about RoboCop and about the fact that you fashioned your physical movements in that movie after the actor Nikolai Cherkasov from Ivan the Terrible Part 2. It's like, wait a minute. There's a big mainstream Hollywood movie influenced by a Russian classic. And then I found there was a second Russian classic.
He's so excited. Yeah. He's knocking over
water bottles. And then I found there was a second Russian classic evoked by a film that summer. And that was The Untouchables, which Brian De Palma staged a sort of a replay of the Odessa Steppes sequence from Potemkin. It's like, wow, I got a piece. I got a story from my TV show, from my very mainstream TV show. And got all that on the air, including you talking about
it. A lot of people won't know who Eisenstein is, though. Unless you know, the sad thing is, what I find sad, I just gave a paper on it at the 16th Century Society, is that you can jump into film school, certain film schools now, and you can go right into, say, postmodern contemporary film, and you don't have to know who Eisenstein is, or D.W. Griffith is, or Renoir, or any of those guys. The guys that you hit the floor as an actor or a director, particularly as a theater actor or a fan of film in the 60s, 70s, 80s, you had to look at those movies. You know, those movies were like cornerstones of the whole art. Nowadays, you can go, no, man, you know what I want to do? I want to study, Jim Jarmusch. That's it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And not to take anything away from him, but you can't start with him.
No, it's the idea. My dad, there's a quote that's, well, a misquote, but essentially goes around on the internet where he says, if your film education begins and ends at Star Wars, then you are severely handicapped. And that is, like, say, not in any way disrespecting Star Wars and everything it's done. But to me, when I meet someone and they tell me they love film, and I say, okay, like what? And they list off the Avengers films, and I get nothing against any of those. But it's the idea to me that if you love something, don't you want to watch and consume as much as possible so that you have a million different ideas and examples? You know, isn't that what's exciting?
You know, Jesse, particularly if you're a director, my dilemma, and I direct a lot of high-end television now, which I have a lot of fun doing because you get, you know, you get 3 weeks to hit a home run or 4 weeks to hit a home run. But at the same time, you know, I run into directors and actually directors of photography and first ADs and so forth who don't have a language for it. So subsequently, I came up with a couple of amazing people who schooled me, and one of them was Mike Nichols. And Mike Nichols would bring up a subject, you know, very funny guy, but also a very acerbic guy. And he would say, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I said, well, I don't know that movie. And he goes, okay, Weller, we will not discuss film noir again until you go see. And he must have done that 15, 16 times in my life, right? And I would go and go, wow. I mean, how could I see, think I was looking at film noir when I'm looking at, you know, Out of the Past, you know, when I haven't seen Cat People or I haven't seen Angel Eyes, I haven't seen any of these people where it started. So subsequently, when you're directing and you go, okay, I want to hinge, that means like walk this person into the room, you know, and there you reveal Leonard, like here comes Jesse, and she walks through the room, and you just stay on her. And you reveal, that's a William Wyler technique that he did over and over and over and over again. And then Godard, you know, bumps it from the you know, with the Nouvelle Vague, the New Wave, and does it like many times. You know, he's hinging people everywhere. So I, you know, I was just discussing this with the director of photography. I had no idea that these hinge shots are that old. You know, that's all, he thinks this is all a product of like postmodern, you know, yeah, doc cinema or something like yeah that. So it's the vocabulary it gives you.
Yes. Exactly.
It's just not the story.
Yes.
That these great films give you, but it's the film vocabulary and how they shot it. And by the way, let me just put this out there. One of my favorite films I saw with my dad when I was a kid, I don't know why I liked it, but something about it resonated with me because it was about likable but evil people.
Hmm.
And I have it in Criterion. And it just came on 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago on a Sunday. Maybe it was a week ago Sunday. And I you know, I recorded it. And my wife came in and sat down, my beautiful wife, Sherry, and she sat down on a Sunday morning. Son was, we had an 8-year-old kid, he was like doing something. And she said, oh my gosh, what'd you do? I said, look. And so it was introduced by the guys on Turner Classic Movies, mm-hmm, and they said this amazing thing. They said, not only do we consider this one of possibly the finest film in America about America, but maybe one of the three finest American films ever made. And it's Sweet Smell of Success.
Ah.
How do you beat that, Leonard?
Oh, you don't.
How do you beat the dialogue? And how do you beat Lancaster's performance in it? You know, as hammy as, and Tony Curtis, who became a friend later on, as hammy as those guys could be, whole shots with him undressing and dressing in the one thing where he's firing yeah everything at the.
Or the way they build up Burt Lancaster's entrance.
Oh my gosh!
They're leading up. You're in the nightclub. Burt Lancaster in this film, which if you haven't seen, you should. 1957, Sweet Smell of Success. He plays a really lethal,
yeah,
and cruel Broadway columnist.
Yeah.
And columnists in those days held a lot of power in their
huge
hands.
You could ruin you or make you.
Yeah,
with
exactly,
one blurb.
Exactly. So they're building up to his our first view of him in this Copacabana-style nightclub. And finally, the next to last shot is him signing a check.
That's
signing
right.
A check up for the club with dinner that night. And then you see him. But they build up to it so perfectly, so beautifully. And that's the outdoor, the exterior photography by James Wong Howe.
Oh, man, is that a killer or
catching
what?
New York at that moment in time. Manhattan.
47 nights. Yeah. I mean, but these are like huge cameras, right? They're big Mitchell. I don't know. Panavision was just starting to come in. But these are big Mitchell cameras that he's shooting at night. The credits are alone.
Dusk. But it's not.
Dusk, yeah.
I love that look.
Yeah. And, you know, the credits from the back of one of those New York Times trucks where they're throwing the newspapers out and Broadway's lit up behind you. The film vocabulary in it is staggering. And to walk from like backlit neon in black and white, by the way, a dark Broadway into the worst phosphorescent lit diner where everything is just blown out. It's not only just changing the focal length on it, you know, you got to stop down at the f-stops.
Yeah.
And to do that then was insanely difficult, but the performances in it are amazing. And there are oneers where people got go through rooms, you follow them all the way through rooms, and the only other shot is the person watching. Oneer means the camera's just following. I don't know. I watched that movie, and you know, it's like watching certain films, like Apocalypse Now. Let's take that for example. One of my oldest friends and beautiful friends I just spent Thanksgiving with him is Lawrence Fishburne. I don't know why he calls me Pee-wee. He's called me Pee-wee all my life. And I call him Lorenzo, and we've called each other. So we were talking about Apocalypse Now, and so there was people at the table that had seen Apocalypse Now because there were 15, 16, 17-year-old, 21-year-olds, right? they know him from other movies and they know TV shows, but they don't know him that he was 15 years old doing Apocalypse Now. And we were all discussing, and my wife brought it up, that, you know, Sweet Smell of Success, Apocalypse Now, maybe there's four other films. You could be going on a dinner date and all of a sudden, you know, you're a cable TV station or whatever comes on and you say, okay, oh, right, I'll just watch Martin Sheen go up the river, yeah. You know, or I'll just watch the Duvall scene.
Lots of luck.
Yeah. Lots of luck. You're there for it is a train wreck. So anyway, my point is that I am in Japan in 1990 something or other at the National Film Festival, Tokyo, and I'm with Vittorio Storaro. Now, Vittorio Storaro arguably shifted the technique of color film, and that he's like one of the first to filter Technicolor. And I didn't know, if you want to read a great book, read by Oswald Morris, the second guy I ever worked with. We Have a Problem, Houston, about him giving our first Moulin Rouge for John Huston, you know, a monochrome bath to bleach it out so it looks like Toulouse-Lautrec, because I did not know the Technicolor was truly the mob. You didn't get your film released, you know, unless they sat down and said, great, the three baths look good, you're released. So you couldn't mess with them. But they sold the lab to Rome, and Storaro, because he was working for people like Dario Argento and expressionistic horror guys, he wanted a monkey around with huge light contrast, like neon beer with a bare light bulb, you know. Now, I mean, now we look at it, you can see that blue, you can see how bare this is, it's like white. This is like yellowish. You could do that now in a chip. That doesn't matter. In the 60s, that was hard to do. Mm-hmm. You had to futz with it and subsequently filter Technicolor. So when I was with him, I said, you know, me, the modernist art guy, I said, who's your favorite painter? And because I knew he'd studied art. And he said, well, have you ever been to Padua to see Giotto in the Arena Chapel? Which is, I said, I don't even know who Giotto is, man. And he took his Versace scarf. I've told this to many DP. He always wears Versace. Like Coppola said to him, Apocalypse Now. He did Apocalypse Now, right? He said, you know, Vittorio's the only guy who could shoot in the mud in the Philippines to come away in a white suit that was never touched. But that's how Vittorio is, man. So he took his Versace scarf and he flipped it and he said, well, Peter, we cannot talk about art. And he walked away. So I, you know, us being an Italian guy and, you know, I'm not Italian, I'm a wannabe, but I went up to him and said, Vittorio, say, pretencioso, which means that's pretty pretentious. And he goes, no, you are pretentious, Peter. You are pretentious because you have no context. You have no, if you tell you go into the Arena Chapel and you see Giotto and you see the first 1:165, like a television frame of space, depth, tears, action, emotion, a movie, then a narrative, first one ever done since Rome, everything comes out of that, Peter. He was telling me, you know, because Giotto is the one artist from whom all Western art stems, and his reputation and his legacy has never come into question since Dante mentioned him. No one, I mean, Picasso, it doesn't matter who you're talking about. Mark Rothko looked at Giotto. Rauschenberg, they're all Giotto-esque, right? So I don't even know who this guy is. So I'm like the guy who says, no, Star Wars. You know, or this kid I just ran into, God bless her, on the set of Y5O. She says, I'm going to film school in Honolulu. I said, what have you seen? She says, well, we're looking at old films now. Like what? Out of Africa. Now, I go, okay, I get it. Out of Africa is brilliant. Is it old?
Please don't
call it old. No, I don't think, yeah. And, you know, Sidney Pollack doing Robert Redford and Meryl Streep in one of her seminal performances. You know, it's a fantastic story, but that's...
Contemporary.
It is. It's contemporary film.
Yeah.
I mean, just like art is. I mean, just what it is. It's postmodern. It's after World War II. It's after the nuke. It's after the Cold War. It's after Vietnam. It's contemporary. Yeah.
To the likes of you and me, but not to not to everybody.
No. It's but we would call that contemporary. Yeah. I mean, that's like.
Wait. I'm supposed to say this now, right? Okay, boomer.
Oh, you're so hip. You're so hip. Yeah, this is this new thing where every time
it's
you
a new
complain,
catchphrase now.
When you complain, and my dad's he's 1950, he's a real baby boomer.
Peter's just a few years.
I'm a boomer.
That,
yeah.
Is that what the denigration
of baby boomers is?
Yes, okay.
Yes, exactly. When you say, you kids don't know what the, you say, okay, boomer, I would never say that in my life, but it's a thing.
Oh, wow.
He loves it. He loves making jokes about Twitter. And he's very...
You're
super hip, Daddy. Yeah. Super hip.
I think your dad is hip.
He's very hip.
Yeah. Well, anyway, that's the point of context. The point of context is, and by the way, that thanks to Vittorio Storaro, who I thanked along with Ali McGraw in my dissertation. You know, I wouldn't have never studied art without those two people.
This is ridiculous.
You have a master's,
a PhD.
Well, you have both a master's, from Syracuse University in Roman and Renaissance art.
Yeah,
and a PhD. In Italian Renaissance art history from UCLA.
That's right.
There's 14 different. Do you sleep?
You know, it's like...
No, the answer is no.
There's not enough time, man.
There's a pause.
There's not enough time. Here's what you do, though. You get up. The first thing you do is hit it for 15 minutes. I play the trumpet every day. I get up and play the trumpet.
Oh, yeah. By the way, he's also a world-class jazz trumpeter.
Thank you. I used to be great. Now I'm mediocre, but I'm surrounded by five guys who make me look great still, you know, because they're session guys and real deal musicians who make their living at it. And, but I love playing the trumpet, and I love playing the bossa nova guitar. But you got to do it early in the morning, and you got to write early in the morning. And then you got to do it before you do emails or phone calls or, you know, you know, think it was otherwise. It goes away. You can't do it. You know, you can't do that one day on Friday. Yeah, I'll do it all on Friday.
Yeah.
You got to do it 15, 20 minutes.
That's how exercise is for me. I have to do it as soon as I get up.
Yeah.
Or else I'm going to put it off and get busy with the day. The other things intrude on your day.
And other things intrude on the day, and it sucks the air out of the balloon, and finally you don't have a day to do that stuff.
Yeah. Now, didn't you play the cornet?
I play the trumpet, and a cornet's just a smaller version of it.
Yeah.
But what I play actually is now a flugelhorn.
Ooh, I love that sound.
Yeah, which is a softer sound.
I love that sound.
And a great company that's gone out of business named Colicchio made me a pocket flugelhorn.
Stop it.
So it's like about that big, but it has the sound of a flugelhorn.
A pocket flugelhorn.
Yeah.
That's my new favorite thing.
Do you play in public or do you just play for your own?
I do. I used to play Jeff Goldblum and I. Jeff Goldblum is a gem, and Jeff Goldblum and I played together in Buckaroo, and then later on we got a great.
You mean in. The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai.
The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai.
Across the Eighth Dimension.
Across the Eighth Dimension. All of those words in that one title, yes. And so Jeff and I have been friends since then, except I met Jeff when he was 19. And I was doing a play for Joe Papp, and he was doing a play for Joe Papp, and that was in 1973. So we go back a long way, and we started playing together in the 80s, and then we got together in people's living rooms with a great guitar player named Peter Harris, who'd won a Grammy with... Bruce Hornsby, and another Grammy with Chuck Mangione. So he's a gifted guy and also an orchestrator for NBC. So the three of us would play. And then Miles Davis, if I can really drop that name, and that's really name dropping. You could drop three names as far as I'm concerned in my lifetime. You could drop Brando.
He'll do.
And you could drop Miles Davis and, you know, I don't know, maybe...
7,000 others.
There's about five that you can really... I mean, the others, you could say, like, I worked with Sidney Lumet. I worked with Mike Nichols. I worked with, like, these people. Elia Kazan brought me into the Actors Studio. Those people are giants.
Yeah.
But Miles Davis is Mozart. Hmm. You know, Miles Davis shifted the course of American music. I mean, there's rap sounds that take his rhythmic sounds from around the corner. I mean, this is like...
Oh, yeah.
So... Miles said, when are you and Goldblum going to get out of those living rooms and get yourself a band?
Miles Davis asked you and Jeff Goldblum.
Goldblum wasn't there, but he knew. He reads a lot, right? And he knew when I met him that I'd had every album he'd ever made since I was 9. My mother turned me on to him. And I'm backstage with him in New Orleans when my mother was still living in 8 other white bread people, you know, who are standing with Miles, and he booked no editorial at all. He didn't care who was listening. And he said, I don't know how he knew Jeff and I had a band, but he said, when are you going to get out of these living rooms and get yourself a band? And I said, Miles, you know, like, where are we going to get a band? Because, so can you drop the F-bomb on this podcast?
Oh, go for it.
Yeah. So I said, Miles, we're going to get a band. And he screwed up his face at me. You know, he talked like that. And he said, well, are you going to get a band? Well, buy one. You got the fucking money. And he walked out the door. You know?
That's the best used F word we've ever had.
Yeah, Miles.
Hands down.
So I ran back to Jeff. I said, Jeff, Miles Davis. It's Miles Davis. Miles Davis, Jeff. Said, we got to get a band. We got to get a band. He goes, well, okay, we could buy one, but where do we find this band? You know, so we asked Peter Harris. Peter says, I'm orchestrating for NBC. I'm not even in touch with bands anymore. So we go on to play the living rooms, and the next thing I knew, I'm doing a movie with Woody Allen, and Woody Allen plays on Monday nights.
He loves it.
Now, Woody Allen is a huge, that's a context of film that people ought to look at that vocabulary, yes. You know, because he's looked at every film.
Yes.
And he's changed his, what they call his style, you know, Gordon Willis was with him, and then he changed it to Carlo De Palma, started moving the camera. He's gone through a whole myriad of changes of style. So I'm talking to Woody. And Brian Hamill was his poster photographer, won all his awards for Manhattan. Remember the Great Bridge?
Yeah. So, gorgeous, yeah.
And Brian is one of Woody's oldest friends. And I'm talking to Brian, and I said, I got to talk to Woody about jazz, man. And I'd known Wood for a while, and I'd gone to see him at Michael's. And I told him this story about Miles, and he says, well, Peter, you know, Miles Davis tells you to get a band. You got to get a band. It's Miles Davis. It's, you know, not a guy in a diner, man. You know, I said, well, Wood, what are we? He's got a band. He says, listen, take the people you got and find a place first. The band will come. Just get out of the living rooms. Go find a restaurant that's empty on the day they're empty. And just ask them if they go in and get and play. And they'll go, sure, because they don't care. Like two people in the place. But make sure, A, you get paid. And I'm not talking about the dinner or the free lunch or the whatever, or the iced tea. But they give you money, even if it's $50. And it will be the happiest $50 you ever made. Now, this goes back to when I was at school. I could make that money. But now, I haven't made any money as a musician. Neither is Jeff. So I tell Jeff, it's not just, and he was in Annie Hall, right? Jeff, yeah. You know, I forgot my mantra. They were a great line, the guy at the telephone. I said, Woody says, we got to get a band. And we should just go find a place first. Then we'll get the musicians. So we went to Le Petit Four on Broadway. It was empty on Saturdays. And me and him and Peter Harris and then Clint Eastwood. That's another name you can drop.
Yeah, right.
Clint Eastwood's son, Kyle. Mm-hmm. I called up Clint and he said, you know, talk to him. I said, Kyle is a great musician.
Great bass player.
Yeah, wonderful bass player. And he became our bass player. And we played this place. And Woody said, in 30 days, you'll have an audience. In 30 days, you'll have an audience. And musicians will come. Because they'll hear about you and they'll come. And sure as heck, musicians came. Now Jeff plays with his group and he's recording, God bless him. And I play with my group. I play at the Grand Havana Room, which is a cigar club, high-end cigar club in Beverly Hills. I play it like every couple of months.
That's
and
so
Jeff,
cool.
Jeff tours. It, you know, it's just the best. It's the best.
Who did you just see this weekend?
Roger Kellaway.
Where?
At Feinstein's at Vitello's,
yeah.
In North Hollywood, with John Clayton on bass, who's
amazing.
Magnificent.
Amazing.
And Bruce Foreman on guitar. So that was the trio.
My dad's a jazz nut who made me a jazz nut.
Are you jazz nuts?
Yes.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
I used
oh,
to.
Oh, you are a big jazz nut. What
oh,
are we
yeah.
talking about? I know you
I said,
are.
No, he works with the LA Jazz Society, things like that.
The happiest money
yeah,
I ever
knew this.
Made. Yeah. One of the most exciting days of my entire life was I opened an envelope and there was a check inside for $65 from the Village Voice.
Wow.
Accepting my review of Duke Pearson and his orchestra, who had played at the Half Note in Manhattan. And I was just over the moon. I wrote for the Voice for the next 2.5 years.
And what year? What years were those?
This is the 1870s. No, the 1970s. The 1970s. Early to mid.
And then his dream.
And I started there at The Voice at the same time as Gary Giddens.
You're kidding me.
Who is brilliant.
Yeah, sure.
Gary, I was a dilettante. Gary was brilliant and still is.
Yeah.
And but
and then
we got to know each other.
His dream was to write liner notes.
I got to do some
to
of
do
that. And I got in the door at Downbeat Magazine. So I had several years of doing that. But we're here to talk about you, Peter. Not
no,
me.
No, no. I'm just... I knew that you were a jazz guy. I knew that. And was Abramowitz still writing for The Voice then?
No.
He was gone.
Not to my knowledge.
Yeah, he was the rocker. Mm-hmm. He was the rock guy, one of the guys who put up Jimi Hendrix and. Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned Mike Nichols. Mike Nichols apparently was a godfather of cinema to many people who worked for him. You know, like a proselytizer and an educator.
I think that was his great gift, that he was mm-hmm. a savant. I mean, mm-hmm. that he was like an imparter of wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And but as articulate and funny a dude, I've never met. Huh. Again, man. I mean, a raconteur and quick, a one-liner, you know, one-liner quick.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess he was. I mean, I was doing a film, Shakedown, with Sam Elliott, one of the last New York action films when New York was filthy before, but it was dangerous. I mean, Sam and I used to, we had security around us, not because we were anybody like extra famous, something like that,
yeah.
but because we were shooting in crack dens and and all sorts of places where you get killed. But I never forget that Cries and Whispers, Ingmar Bergman's Cries and Whispers had just been restored. So Cries and Whispers was what, 1973 or something like that? This is 1988. It's been restored. And it's being re-released. So Sam is asking me about Cries and Whispers. Should he go see it? He always heard Bergman was something, you know. And Sam's a country guy, but he's always curious. It's a beautiful thing about him. And he's almost innocent in his curiosity. I got to direct him and justify it a 2 years ago. What a gem of a human being, too. So he said, should I go see this, this Cries and Whispers, right? I said, yeah, Sam, I mean, if you're going to see any Bergman, first of all, the photography. So the operator, whose name I will not mention, but he's a pretty famous operator in New York, says, Bergman is overrated. Bergman is, you know, they call Seventh Seal, you know, it's overrated. It's like hype. And Sven Nykvist is like, who cares? I mean, it's static, you know, tableau photography with no particular invention. I said, well, I disagree, man. I think that, like, you know, this is the second wave of feminism. If you see Persona, that may be the all-time feminist film ever. I can't think of anything that anybody of any gender has ever made or written or filmed that tells more about the dilemma of a woman with a woman in any facet, whether it's love, jealousy, envy, violence, what have you. So I say, I disagree. And he goes, I don't know. So that night, I have this dinner. We would have these dinners once in a while. It would be me and Carrie Fisher and Mike. And Carrie Fisher was my, God bless her, was one of my first, was maybe my first friend ever in L.A. Carrie Fisher, I met before Star Wars came out. I was doing streamers with Mike. She had come to see it with her best friend, another wonderful guy and a great actor, Griffin Dunn. Mm. She was 19, I think I was 26, something like that. We became fast friends. She took me to Disneyland. And then we would have these seminars with Mike off and on. So here we are at this in this Chinese restaurant. And Mike says, how's your movie going? I go, like, it's interesting. He says, you know, by the way, Cries and Whispers just re-released today. You know, we got to see it. So I tell him about this conversation with Sam. And here's what Mike says. Okay, Weller. I knew I was going to get lectured to when he calls me the last name. Yeah, what is his name? He says, and I told him, he says, oh my God, not him. He's good. And I said, yeah. He says, well, here's what we do. You never work with him again. Now, he's serious, man. Because anybody who says they are a photographer, who calls Sven Nykvist boring, or Ingmar Bergman overrated and unimportant, you must never work with again. And that's how lethal and intolerant he was with stupidity.
Mm-hmm.
So on the one hand, he's a scholar and a giver of knowledge and a raconteur and a funny guy. On the other hand, he is a obliterating, impudent assassination of anybody without taste.
Hmm.
You know, he was not interested even in, like, accepting people without taste. And that's Mike, you know. So
now I want to mention another name, and I don't know, I'm not leading the witness here because I don't know what you're going to say, but you were directed on stage by Otto Preminger.
Correct.
What was that experience like?
Horrible. And there are many stories.
There are.
And the most of which is, I have to tell you, it was really, the thing I take away is that, yeah, I was at play with B.B. Anderson. And B.B. Anderson.
Oh, my.
And B.B. Anderson and Leonard
Nimoy.
From
Ingmar Bergman's stock
company. From Persona. From Persona. And she gave me this in the days where you couldn't get publicity photographs. She gave me that great picture of her and Liv Ullmann. And she says, for my friend Peter, with friendship and love. And it's in my office wall. So, but this, Preminger was huge, bald, and mean, and spit. And he talked at 80 million decibels. And, you know, he would talk like that all the time. And there was, and I would tell Mike, later on I would tell Mike this. And there's, I jump ahead about Mike. Mike says, you know, his the guy he escaped the Wehrmacht from, because he was from Vienna, is Sam Spiegel, the great Sam Spiegel. I mean, how many great movies did he produce? And Sam Spiegel was German and Otto was Viennese. I think they were together in Berlin or something, and they escaped together. But Spiegel, who knew him, since, according to Mike, would say, Otto, and I, if it wasn't for the fact that you're Jewish, you'd have gone right to the top of the Reich. And that's his like best friend telling him that. Now Spiegel could probably say that because his two Jewish kids are on the run. They ran to Bremerhaven, got a train to Bremerhaven, and split for London. But Otto was an art collector. He had a blue period Picasso behind his chair, and always elegant and an entourage. If it wasn't like Andy Warhol and all those guys, I mean, all amazing painters and the New York clique would follow him into rehearsals and so on.
I want to ask you, I want to jump around a little bit. You directed a short subject in 1993 that was nominated for an Academy Award.
Yes.
And the cast is just the most killer lineup of
people. Comedic, yeah.
I'm going to just read the name. It's from a Thomas McGuane story.
That's right.
Short story.
Who was a great guy, yeah.
Griffin Dunn, who you mentioned, Mark Helgenberger, Ed Begley Jr., Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Seymour Cassell, Charles Fleischer, Robert Hayes, Joseph Marr, Kevin Nealon, Charles Martin Smith, and the late, great J.T. Walsh.
That's right.
That is a hell of a cast.
David Rashi's on there?
No.
David Rashi also.
Oh.
Who came up with the best line I've ever heard in a film anywhere? And Griffin Dunn has got a, like, it's about paranoia in a law firm, of mm-hmm. course. And Griffin Dunn's got to overhear that chorus of lawyers talking with JT and Charlie Martin Smith and Alan Rosenberg and Brian Gordon and Ed. And I yelled down to him. I said, I need one ad lib, like when he comes over, as if you change the subject when he's listening. And JT goes, yeah, Rashi's got it. Rashi's like from improv theater. And so there's Griffin coming to the edge, and he looks over, and just as he looks over, Rashi says, and the cow was returned to its rightful owner. And they all walk away, man. It may be one of the most brilliant lines I have ever heard.
Well, I love it on sight. That's it. That's
yeah,
great.
Those guys
so
were great.
Now, how
I didn't get to hang out with them, Leonard. Is the thing. I was setting up. They were all sitting in the green room telling amazing theater stories. I mean, can you imagine Seymour Cassell and Kevin Nealon and Rashi and Ed Begley and Bob Hayes and these guys that, like, Charlie Martin Smith, you know, all mm-hmm. telling theater stories and laughing. I could hear them laughing
yeah.
for hours, and I never heard what they were saying.
Where did you grow up? Because obviously you said
I'm
army
an army
bases,
brat.
So
yeah.
So where were you born?
I was born right in Stevens Point, Wisconsin. My grandfather was in the English department there, University of Stevens Point. My grandmother was a piano teacher and a kindergarten teacher. I was born there, but didn't spend much time there. I got pneumonia when I was very young, and they moved me out to I think Panama City, Florida, where one of my uncles was. My father was in the Army, a bombardier, and then going into helicopter school and so forth. So he was moving around a lot. And I grew up essentially mostly in Texas. We ended up in Texas.
What part of Texas?
San Antonio, mm-hmm. For the most part. San Antonio, Austin area.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We went back and forth through there. Mm-hmm. But to tell you the truth, my father had a twin brother, just passed away in 96. Great guy.
Kinahara, that's all right.
And he spent most of his adult life from the 40s, from the World War II on, in New Orleans. So my cousin, Frederick Weller, a really good theater actor, and a really good actor too, is my cousin, followed my footsteps. I was always in New Orleans. I just got back from New Orleans. And I'm in New Orleans a lot. So New Orleans is more of a home to me than any place. Because anytime we had downtime, we were in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
With the uncles and aunts and cousins or whatever. That's really where the family is.
And when did all of this become interesting to you? I mean, honestly, looking through the things you've studied and the fact that you do a little bit of everything, it's frankly overwhelming how much you know and how much you've done. But for you as a kid, what did one come first?
No, you know, I always wanted to be Miles Davis.
There are worse things.
Well, look, when Whiplash came, you know, two movies came out in one year that just reduced me to ash. And one was Whiplash. And I went to North Texas State. I was with the 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock bands. There's like six bands. You had to really fight to get in them. Most kids could not get in them. The 1 o'clock band birthed, you know, Lou Marini and Bones Malone, all these guys that you see on Leno and whoever, right?
And just to be clear, North Texas State, which was then called University...
Now it's called University of North Texas. Then it was called North Texas State.
Okay.
But Leon Breeden is the first guy to ever set up a contemporary music school.
Huh.
Like, if you were going to study music at Judah or any place, this is before Berklee School of Music in Boston, mm-hmm. Before Indiana, mm-hmm. It's before Miami, it's before all these amazing places. The North Texas State was it.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody, every band there was, went through there to pick up musicians for the summer.
Yes, I was telling Jesse that as we were coming over today, just so people understand, that was like the ne plus ultra of jazz education.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That was the ne plus ultra of jazz education. That was it. That was a sine qua non of contemporary music. And
I have no more Latin. It's done.
That's
now.
Right.
Yeah. It's over.
So in any case, that's where I went. I wanted to be, and I saw Whiplash. I said, that was me.
Yeah.
It wasn't necessarily Leon Breeden, but it was his underlings who in 1 o'clock were going, Weller, measure 48, 2, 3, 4, boom. And if you didn't cut it, Jesse in, Weller out. You know, and finally after that, I think like, okay, I'm playing, I'm doing it. But do I want to go through this for the rest of my friggin' life, you know, for $49 and change? And then I realized I'm not going to be Miles Davis. What else am I going to do? The only other thing I did was act. So I'm in the theater department, kind of, as a loose goose thing not to go to Vietnam. So when I saw Whiplash, you know, and how terrifying that is, like somebody called me up and said, wow, they made a movie about going to jazz school. It certainly sounds like you. And I go, look, there's no one who's going to make a movie about going to music school anywhere, particularly contemporary music, that's going to get it. And then I saw that movie and I was reduced to ash, right? I was just reduced to nothing. And then the thing that kicked it is a month later, a buddy of mine calls me up and says, hey, man, a different buddy, there's a movie out that will really nail you. And I went, I've already seen it, Whiplash. He goes, no, I'm not talking about that. It's about dignity after action hero, finding dignity after action hero. It's really about the actor, but it's about you too. What is that? Birdman. So then I go see Birdman, and that just brought me to end, man. I thought, God bless you, Michael Keaton, speaking for, you know, the five of us who have said no to part three.
Right.
Which he did, and I did. And maybe some other people did because we wanted to find the other way. And that movie just, it made me laugh and cry at the same time. So two movies in one year just reduced me, man.
Wow.
You know, and you somebody's going to come up and tell you that, hey, there's a movie about your life. No, it's not.
No, there's no way. They don't know me.
They don't know what it is to do RoboCop in life after RoboCop.
Yes.
Right? Yes, they do. Somebody there knows. And Anna Ritu pinned it. And they don't know what it is in music school. Yeah, they do, man. So that's what I want to be, Miles Davis. And I wasn't Miles Davis. So then I was going to be an actor. And then I never forget it. I was hitchhiking down to Austin when my father had left, retired from the United States Army, was going to law school, and a guy picks me up, business guy, and goes, in those days you could hitchhike, right? Down
yeah, yeah. 35.
He says, what do you do? And I said, out of my mouth said, I'm an actor. And I went, that's it. He says, really, where do you act? I said, well, now I'm in university, but I'm going to go to New York. And those words came out, and sometimes the words precede.
Yes.
Like what the Tibetan Buddhism, they call it a bardo. It's a crack in your reality. And all of a sudden, the world is taking you a place that you're not thinking of, right? It's just, it's metaphysical.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now you studied with Uta Hagen.
The great Uta Hagen. Yeah.
Who I got to see just once on stage.
God, I saw her too. Memorable. She killed me. I saw her twice. I said, wasn't she amazing?
Yes.
Yeah.
I saw it was a very light show, but a charming show she did with David Hyde Pierce, Six Dance Lessons.
Yeah.
I can't remember the name of it. Wonderful, wonderful piece.
Yeah.
A vehicle for these two fine actors.
I mean, I look back at this. You know, I've been doing this for 50 years, and all I can do is thank God. Like Miles said that. To Daryl Jones, who's now the Rolling Stones bass player, but that Rolling Stones bass player was discovered by Miles. He was 19. Miles picked him out of a band in Chicago and said, all you can do, right? We'd call him up in the middle of the night. He said, Daryl, are you on your knees? Why, Miles? No, I'm sleeping. We just played 3 years. He says, get on your knees, because the only thing you can do is thank God for your gifts. Click, and hang up on him. And Daryl must have got that call like for 6 months when he was like first touring with him. And so I bring that up to Miles, and Miles says, that's all you can. I didn't know Miles is spiritual, you know, but you could bet he was. All you can do is thank God for the opportunities, the gifts, and so forth. And even if you're like an atheist or agnostic, thank something. Because your mind ain't doing all of it. You know what I'm saying? There's something out there, a world working in your favor or leading you from, okay, you're not going to be Miles Davis, but you guess what? You get to have 50 years minimum of a theater and film career. Mm. Okay, is that all right with you?
Yeah.
You know, I was probably when I was 21, I was giving it up. I said, no, I want to be Miles Davis. But
you're Peter Weller.
Yeah,
yeah. I am.
And you've done a damn good job being Peter Weller.
I appreciate it. Now I got an 8-year-old kid, and as you know, I'm sitting with your kid. He's got one of the most gorgeous smiles on planet Earth. You've been told that all your life?
I just get told that I have his smile. We have the same.
Is that right? Yeah, you got the same smile.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah, it is kind of a Cheshire cat, like you know something I don't know. Yeah.
What have you enjoyed watching with your 8-year-old recently?
Star Wars!
Yay!
Yeah, man. And he's got to play Star Wars on a piano in a talent contest on Friday, which is making me nervous. But he wanted, he was going to watch number 3, because he's watched the new ones.
Sure. Yeah.
But he never went back and watched the first 3.
Mm-hmm.
And he was going to watch number 3. And I said, Teddy, you can't watch number 3. He says, nope, Dad, I can watch any movie I want. It's my TV. It's my time to watch movies. I go, well, you want to hit, let me finish? See, number 1, and then Mom gets in. Mom explains it better. Number 1, 2, and 3 are one story. It's all one story. And if you watch number 3 before you watch number 1, you're not going to understand it. He goes back and watches number 1, 2, 3, and now he's obsessed with it. So that's that. I just watched, he watched Monsters, Inc.
I love that movie.
I do too.
I love
Monsters, Inc. Mm-hmm. Don't you?
Still makes me smile.
Yeah. You know what my favorite is? Hmm. The Secret Life of Pets.
Isn't that beautiful?
One and two. Like,
visually, isn't that stunning?
And so, the moral of the story?
Yes, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful story. But visually, that's what blew my mind, was seeing it. And it's a famous artist.
Eric Guillon, who is credited with both production design and I think character design as well.
Breathtaking.
Yeah, he's a real talent.
But that's what's fun. You know, everything you're talking about, Peter, and being inspired and excited about art. It can go to Monsters, Inc. It doesn't have to be, you know, it doesn't have to be the kind of thing where we're only talking about
Otto
Preminger. And, yeah, exactly. You know, you're speaking about Picasso.
And by the way, you know, I make fun of Otto Preminger. I do imitations of him. So did Leonard. But You know, he did a couple of Anatomy of Murder. You can watch that over and over again.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
Laura. No. He's not taking anything away from
but
what
he's a
they
nut.
Create. He's like, exactly. But that's what I find inspiring is that if you're someone who loves art, you love art. So it's not, I only love this. I only love that. It is watching Monsters, Inc. and being able to say, I mean, it's a wonderful movie in general, story-wise. But in terms of looking at it, I remember when it came out and seeing Sully's hair move.
Yeah.
That was the first time we'd seen that. And Pixar has done this many times now, where every time I think that it can't look better than it does, they knock you out.
They knock you down.
You know, I saw Tangled and I said, this is the most beautiful movie I've ever seen. Then Coco comes out. And you go, holy shit, this is the most incredible one.
Yeah.
Again, forgetting the story, just looking at visually speaking.
Yeah. And now a very dear friend of mine, a long time, and a guy plays jazz with me, and he plays tuba. David Silverman directed that.
Yeah.
Oh, directed the first Monsters, Inc. And let me just turn this phone
sure.
on.
Sure,
sure.
And so I talk to him all the time about how do you do that? I mean, how do you? I get doing this. He's the lead animator on The Simpsons.
Simpsons, yeah.
Yeah.
So I get how you could do The Simpsons. You draw them. You got this idea. But making those people, those.
How do you make an eyeball adorable?
Yeah.
You know,
how do
yes,
you add, yeah.
But that's it. Yeah, yes, you have a little girl. Boo is precious. And right. again, Disney, Pixar, a lot of them, they do this very well, that adorable little girl, little boy. But in a similar way, we watched Bug's Life again recently. Why are ants adorable?
I know. Bug's Life, I love it.
How did you make an eyeball in Monsters, Inc. funny and cute? It really is a beautiful art form. And I am always amazed by that they take creatures, critters, Wally, you know, he's a robot.
Yeah.
And yet those sad eyes break your heart.
I love that movie, Wally. Yeah.
It's very special.
What's your favorite film, Leonard?
Casablanca.
Casablanca.
God, how do you get better than that?
Since I was 15 years old, it's been my favorite.
What do you say
it's
yours?
Everything. Everything aligns.
Yeah.
In that film.
What's yours?
Everything.
Do you have
Bob McKee's story analysis, right, that I took twice, amazing, when I first started to direct, because that guy's gifted by his own admission, you know. And so a writer, but he could certainly teach what Aristotle, speaking of Aristotle, you know, demanded, and Aristotle didn't think it up, he took it from Homer, you know, that every story has three parts, a beginning, middle, and end, and the middle has two parts, so you got essentially four parts. And you spend the last Sunday taking apart Casablanca, which he says is the perfect film.
Perfect screenplay.
Yeah. It's the perfect screenplay and a perfect film.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And I know it's it's 90 minutes long, it's 138 pages. I mean, they're talking so fast, man. It's amazing how fast people could talk then.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, and how to tell a story with not a wasted moment,
no.
not one,
and not an unnecessary moment.
And using close-ups when you need them. None of this, the cameras inside of someone's face.
I mean,
you know,
that's the sad thing about television. I mean, that's the thing about television directing too, is that you know, I just worked with and I'm working now as an actor on a show that I direct, and I was with a director who I really like, and all of a sudden he started shot collecting, what I call shot collecting. Like, we got to do this, got to do that, got to do that. Another day, he never did that. He would save those for... So, yeah, saving close-ups to... You know, cable TV is coming back more and more with that.
Oh, no. There's many things are happening, and we're very lucky because we have a plethora of places.
Yeah.
But I remember you talking about specifically,
Casablanca.
Daddy, the lighting, the way that they lit when they would do her close-ups.
Yeah.
And
how about when she's looking at
that
lace?
But that's
that
but her eyes, the way they got this sort of a sparkle in them. And
it's a pinpoint.
Yeah,
it's
light very specific.
Right in the pupils of the eyes that they used to do for women in particular, for glamour photography.
Yeah,
and
you sit there and you go, "Yep, most beautiful woman in the world. Got it.
Yeah.
Best cinematographer in the world.
She
got
is
it."
Like hard to beat.
Yeah, although her daughter's pretty damn close. Yeah. She's right up there.
Are you
Isabella Rossellini?
Yeah, just. Oh, pretty staggering.
Just like her mother can take those close-ups.
Can you believe that we booted her out because she had an affair out of wedlock with an Italian man?
Please.
I mean, what are we living under, a rock or something,
I know,
man?
Yeah. I know.
I mean, that's just like frightening. They're stupid. And well, you know, the thing that busted it, I met her once, and what a force of nature, is that Vanessa Redgrave had a kid with Franco Nero, right?
Yes.
Who was your kid with Franco Nero? Was it?
I can't remember.
Wasn't sadly who passed away.
No.
So anyway, she has this kid, and she's a hottie, Vanessa Redgrave, in the 60s. And Franco Nero is like...
Franco Nero.
Franco Nero, man. And she said, I'm paraphrasing it. I mean, she's almost 6 feet tall. This is like 1964 or something like that. And people say, this is going to ruin your career. She says, so what? And you decide to have a child out of wedlock? She says, yeah, he's the best looking guy in the world. How can I not? And you think like... I wish I had that kind of courage, man.
Yeah.
Right?
You know, I thought I had courage, but for a woman to say that then, only 10 years after we've booted a woman out for having a legitimate affair, right, and not just a couple of one-night stands and someone have your kid, but like a long-time affair with a guy, you know, out of wedlock. Can you believe that we threw her out of the country? I mean, my God, you cannot legislate morality. Once
Are you enjoying directing?
I love directing. I love directing. People say, you know, I love acting also, but directing, I'd rather tell a story than perform in it.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Yeah, I prefer to direct than act.
Hmm. Well, we prefer to have you talk as long as you want to some other time. Come back.
I'd love to.
We'll do it again.
Pardon me. I have the beginnings of a cold. I have to get on an airplane and go to the largest Comic-Con in England in Manchester.
Manchester's my other home. It's where my husband's from.
Really?
Yeah.
What do they call it? Manchurian or what?
He's a Mancunian.
Mancunian.
I'm married to a Mancunian.
As much as they money as they pay you for a Comic-Con, or pay me and pay some other people, including Jeff Goldblum, Christopher Lloyd, and a lot of other people, the best thing about it is that it gives an actor or a performer the dignity of shaking hands with a populace who have been watching you for the 50 years and go, thank you. And you get to thank them back. And there's something fantastic in that. There's something just really, it's a gift to hang out with the populace, you know?
Yeah.
So I'll leave it with that.
God bless you for appreciating that.
Yeah.
For acknowledging it and appreciating it.
I appreciate that, Leonard, but you know, it's something I had to learn, because I'll leave you with this. Mm-hmm. I'm a young theater actor. I read the longest interview done with Christopher Porterfield and Marlon Brando on the set of Missouri Breaks. Somebody's yelling outside, some production assistant. I'm paraphrasing, but Porterfield says, what's that? And Brando says, it's some, you know, PA yelling at another PA being an asshole, which is what the movie business does. How the theater business does. And Porterfield says, wait a minute, what do you mean it does? He says, it makes everybody, for a second, an asshole. Right? Because you can't be around the perks of this stuff without thinking it's about you. And it doesn't matter if you're a 19-year-old PA whose uncle on the board of directors got you the gig, all the way up to the board of directors. Right? Somewhere in there, you think it's about you. And I'm reading this when I was 23. That's not going to be me. I am Mr. like, you know, cold water flat New Yorker method actor. Cut to 10 years later and a whole bunch of money and a Ferrari. I'm this guy. Why is my Winnebago not in front of a fucking stage? Why do I have to walk 50 fucking yards? And there I am, the asshole. Right? I am that asshole. And it's what Brando said, no matter what your paycheck, whether you slap yourself awake and realize you are doing a 9-to-5 blue-collar gig in the service of entertainment. So I appreciate you saying that. God bless me for realizing that. But it took some dignity and humility learned and a couple things recalled by my mom to go, oh, yeah, man, this is a gift, and I better thank these people and be with them and so forth. Because I could be that prick in a second. I said, I don't want to grovel with humanity. I want to champion humanity. I just don't want to hang out with them. You know, hanging out with humanity is the only thing that gives you some sort of humility and compassion. And by the way, exhilaration about being alive, mm-hmm. right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Well, you exhilarated us.
Thanks.
You truly did. So nice to meet you and to have you here.
Well, I would love to come back.
Well,
I'd love to have you back.
I find the two of you inspiring to be around.
Oh well.
And a massive thank you to J.D. Pichet, my friend, who is the person that connected us.
So thanks to J.D.
Massive
thank
you,
J.D.
And thank you, Peter. And
thank you, Leonard. And thank you, Jesse.
Thank you.
And thank you, folks, for listening. You can find us where?
You are at Leonard Maltin, and I am at Jesse Maltin on Instagram and Twitter. And you can go to leonardmaltin.com for movie reviews, book roundups, and all kinds of good stuff.
And if you want to check out our Patreon, go to
Maltreon.
Patreon.com/Maltin on Movies. Patreon.com/Maltin on Movies. If you want to support what we're doing. Thanks for listening. Today's episode of Maltin on Movies is brought to you by Legion M, the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. If you love movies as much as we do, why not own a piece of them? Find out more at www.legionm.com.